You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. Is the summer coming in? I don't know. We've had so much rain over the last couple of weeks. Maybe we'll have the rainy season up until December, but who knows? Anyway, I know you've enjoyed the last few episodes, especially 251, 252, and 253. Those are the academic talking about our unnamed academic talking about the FARC and what they're up to in their lives at the moment as they wait for reincorporation. It's been the most popular show of all time on the Columbia Calling podcast. And 252, of course, with Paula Ferrero of Semana Magazine, Semana Rural, and Arranca App, talking about tourism and reconciliation in lots of areas of Colombia. So it's good to hear stories about this. And 253, where we talk about the 100 days of Duque, that's President Duque, with Señor Guzmán, Sergio Guzmán from Colombia Risk Analysis. So talking about the president and his particularly weak situation at the moment. But we're changing tack a little bit in this episode 254. As you can hear in the background, because she's already on the line, we are plugged into authentic Colombia, and you can hear the cockerels, you know, the roosters crowing in the background. You'll probably hear dogs and motos because it's Pueblo life. We are on the line to Minca, which is in the Sierra Nevada, so Magdalena Department, just up above Santa Marta, and we're talking to Arizona native Shenandoah Cornish, who's doing some great projects up there. And she was put in touch with me. Well, she got in touch because a traveler came through Minca and said, you have to listen to this podcast and you have to get in touch with Richard. So I always love this kind of connection. So let me just say welcome on Columbia Calling, Shenandoah.
Thank you so much. And also, I want to give a really quick shout out to Marnie Bedrich, who was the one that recommended that we get in touch. I promised her that I'd give her like a shout out if I got the chance to talk to you. So,
oh, we like that. We like the feedback. And so hopefully she hears that and calls in and says that she's very happy and flattered and so on. But Shenandoah, let's start. Shenandoah Cornish. What brought you, well, I mean, I know a little bit about you, but what brought you to Minca? I mean, you've been living there for a little bit now.
Yeah, I've been here almost 3 years now. I'm not really sure how that happened. It definitely wasn't my plan, but I came to the area. I actually first came to Colombia to a job. I was finishing up in school and I got a call from a program in Barranquilla to work with an international student exchange program. And it was terrible. I didn't like the work. Barranquilla was just like a big, hot, chaotic city. And I'm from a small mountain town. I'm from Flagstaff. So I kind of asked my friends in Barranquilla, I was like, I need a mountain. Where's the closest mountain? And they sent me here. And I just fell in love with Minca. I fell in love with everything about it. And it's a really incredible town in the sense that it seems so small and simple, but the more time you spend here, the more interesting it gets. I guess like most places in Colombia. So it's like way more interesting now, almost three years later, than it was like getting to know it the first few days. Because when you first come here, you see like nature all over the place and it's really beautiful, but you don't even touch the tip of the iceberg because the place is so much more than nature. It's history, it's culture. There's so much that's happened here.
That's really cool. I mean, I've only been for a few days to Minca, and I obviously loved it. It was several years ago, and I need to go back. I need to find a way of convincing my wife that we can go. It was just about getting in the car, driving up from when we're in Mompox one of these times, and just coming up and hanging out. But So, I mean, you know, you've come to this with a different background, though. You came to Minca, okay, you were, let's say, it's escaping from Barranquilla, but you came to Minca having studied topics like cultural identity and ethno-nationalism. So you're coming with a different, let's say, set of eyes when you arrive at a place like Minca, and I think that's maybe why it opened up to you more, perhaps.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And that I do remember being one of my, like, the most surprising things for me in Colombia in general when I first came here was that I kept going and visiting and doing tours, but I was, like, missing a little bit about history and culture, mm-hmm. and I didn't really speak Spanish when I first came here. So it was really hard for me, like, literally without the words, it was really hard for me to ask.
Mm.
And so I, like, stayed here and I made it my business to learn Spanish so that I could ask people why they don't talk about their history. And obviously there's so many reasons why they don't. But I guess coming from that academic background that I had, I was, like, very, very interested and determined to do it because I was like, if it's missing for me, I'm sure it's missing for other people also.
Well, I think this is a Colombia-wide issue that you have recognized very quickly, and of course, coming from your academic background. But before we delve into that a little bit more, because I find it absolutely fascinating, something, a main issue that's coming up in my doctoral thesis is that of identity here in Colombia. And there's so much related to it. You know, I just don't think that people really have got their heads around it. But tell us a little bit about, you know, when you study ethno-nationalism, what is it exactly?
Yeah, so cultural identity and ethno-nationalism, the idea behind that is when people usually look at international relations and, like, the international community, they see countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important to recognize, yes, there are countries, but in some cases, identities that aren't geopolitical are even more important. So you have places all over the world, like Catalonia, in Spain, País Vasco, even Scotland, places that say, yes, we're a part of this country, but we have a different history, a different language, a different culture, a different identity.
That's so fascinating.
I think it's really important to recognize that and recognize its importance in the world, especially, as you say, in places like Colombia, where, you know, Colombia could be seven different countries because there is such a huge variety of ethnicities, of cultures, all kinds of things. And I think looking at identity is especially important when you're looking at countries like this because you really understand why they've had the conflicts they've had, why they've had the problems they had. Even if you look at, like, because I guess identification as a part of a group of the armed conflict is also an identity issue. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at things like a peace process, if you don't look at, like, the identity issues behind that, it's really hard to make progress.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I find this really interesting. I mean, you come to identities that are non-geopolitical, and that's Colombia in a nutshell. I mean, that's the tenuous, of course, unifying link of Colombia having been, you know, part of the Spanish Empire. But it's tenuous at best when you think of the melting pot of, let's say, well, you know, what does that have to do with the Wayuu and the Guajira and the people of the Chocó on the Pacific coast? I mean, there's really that these tenuous links that I think probably only tether together the urban areas and urban, let's say, liberal elites. It's when you're talking about identities in this situation, I mean, you really are, you're going beyond the you know, the superficial. It's very clear. And you found somewhere in Minca where you've been able to explore this more.
Yeah, I kind of realized you have to start small. You have to be small because otherwise it's just overwhelming.
Mm.
Even Minca alone is overwhelming.
But tell us a second, how many people are living in Minca at the moment? Do you have an idea?
No, they're actually trying to do a new census because it's changing so quickly, both because of foreigners, travelers, but also because of the crisis in Venezuela. Mm. So they're trying to do a new census. But I think the last time they tried to count, it was almost 2,000.
Wow. I mean, and Minca exactly, I mean, how far, it's not just that the small town where the bridge is. I mean, it extends further, right? I mean, there's a kind of like a catchment area that is Minca.
Yeah, I always describe it to people as like a spider.
Okay.
Like this is the body of the spider, but it like goes out in every direction. It's way bigger.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, if it was like a couple of thousand, I can't imagine so many people up there. But tell us then, Shenandoah, what is it that you are doing there? I mean, you know, we're in touch because you've got a Centro de Memoria up there in Minca, and I think we're going to get into that more in depth, but in the last couple of minutes of this first segment, tell us a little bit about how you decided to set up a type of museum in Minca.
Yeah, so like I said, this piece of like history and culture was something that was really missing for me, that I was thinking about why I travel, because I fell in love with traveling a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's really like that opportunity to have a different perspective of the world, to imagine what life would be like if you had this different history, if you had this different background. And I think that's something that was missing here, because when I came here, there was so much tourism arriving to this area. There's like busloads every day, but people like go take selfies in the waterfalls and then leave. And I think for such a rich place, it's missing like the most interesting part. The most interesting part people don't even get the chance to hear about or ask about. So I started collecting history and like doing interviews as part of a hobby, and I thought maybe it would turn into like an article or an academic project one day. But then I was like, wait a second, I can do something with this right now, because if this was missing for me, I'm sure it is for other people too. And so I actually spent a year trying to convince my boyfriend to open it with me, and there were a lot of reasons why he was tentative to do that. One of them for safety issues, because as I'm sure you well know, there's still a lot of political difficulties in the area. So it was a year-long debate. Can we open this? Can we not? How do we present it in like the most objective, unbiased way possible? And I finally convinced him this summer. So we opened in July, and we've been open since then, just like starting really, really low with like no funding whatsoever. And just like going step by step, just trying to share like history and culture with the people that come through. And we've had really, really good reactions so far. So we're really, really grateful for that.
And so who are the type of people who visit then? And where are you getting, let's say, stories and images from members of the community? You're collecting these things. I imagine you're transcribing them. But who are the kind of people who come in and visit?
I would say the majority. Well, something I've been really encouraged by, I have to say first, is how the demographic of travelers here in the area has been changing. Mm. When I first came here, it was very much like grungy backpackers that were here for like nightlife and parties for the most part. And now there's a lot more older people, professionals, families, students. And I would say it's those kinds of people that find their way here, just because those tend to be the people that like aren't going to be entertained by nights and nights and nights of nightlife and partying. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, they're people that like would like something a little bit more profound, a little bit more engaging, more than like Instagram pictures, and they find their way here.
That's cool.
Really great.
That's cool. Well, you see, I'm contracted on from time to time to give talks about Colombia politics and so on and what's going on in history to groups of tourists, groups and so on here in Bogota and elsewhere. And I always say that, it's interesting to see. And I think there's something you get to each time when you sort of say it's like, listen, we talk about the good things, we talk about the bad things in Colombia, and we start collecting the stories, because one of the reasons that you are here, and you have to say it, is because there has been so much bad news, and this does awaken a curiosity in you. We do need to talk about it, and I think this goes back to your identity issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also really important to tell that history in its context. Mm-hmm. I'm really encouraged by the fact that there's a lot more national initiatives to look for history and to do conflict resolution, to interview people that are from conflict areas. But I think we also need spaces that don't only talk about the conflict, but to talk about other parts of the history also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the conflict is like really, I guess it's like the headline news. You know, this place has a lot of interesting history in the Sierra Nevada. There's four different indigenous groups. There's a really rich history with like coffee and the first people to come to the region because of that, with Simón Bolívar. This was he died in Santa Marta, and actually we've heard from some people that his plan before he died was to come up to Minka for health issues. You know, there's so much history here, and sometimes that gets overshadowed by the conflict. So we try to, obviously we do talk about the conflict, we talk about its history and the impact it's had on Minka, but we try as much as we can to keep it in context of, like, that is not the thing that happened, it is one of many things that happened.
I think you're completely on the money in that one, and I actually, that issue, that little snippet of perhaps Simon Bolivar coming up to Minka for health issues, I had no idea. That's really interesting. And putting it all into context, of course, the conflict is the most immediate. It's the most contemporary issue, so that's why it's talked about. But it has to be addressed. But like you say, prior to that, there was so much more. We're going to take a short break, though, Shenandoah, and we're going to come back with you and talk further about your museum, the Centro de Memoria de la Sierra, up there in Minka. It's located in the Casa Balaguer, very easy to find. You can seek out Shenandoah Cornish, and I'm sure she'll give you an amazing, let's say, background to everything to do with Minka and the region. So we're going to come back and talk about some of the anecdotes and some of the stories that the people of Minka have been giving to Shenandoah over this time. And so, she opened in July. They've got to have stories by now. So we'll take a short break. This is episode 254. I'm Richard McCall talking to Shenandoah Cornish, a native from Arizona in Minka Magdalena. So don't go away. We'll be right back with more stories from the Sierra Nevada. So thank you for listening. Bye-bye. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, episode 254. I'm in Bogota, and my very special guest this week, Shenandoah Cornish, is in Minka Magdalena, so just up behind the city of Santa Marta, the city where Simon Bolivar passed away. And you can go and visit the Quinta San Pedro Alejandrino. And of course, we just heard in the last segment that Bolivar had been thinking of going up to Minka for his health issues before he died. So something I didn't know. We're talking it's a very interesting conversation that deals with identity and cultural identity and ethno-nationalism, because Shenandoah Cornish is an expert in this. Now, she set up with her boyfriend the Centro de Memoria de la Sierra in the Casa Balaguer. It's free to enter. She calls it a museum, but it's more like a family photo album up there in Minka. And you can give voluntary donations, of course, once you're there. Now, first and foremost, Shenandoah, I want to know how you convinced your boyfriend, first and foremost, to open this museum.
that was interesting. He was nervous because of different political issues area, and I was trying to tell him about the impact that memorial centers had had on me, mm-hmm. because my mother's side of the family are Holocaust survivors, and obviously, like, starting memorial centers is a huge, huge part of that culture, because their idea is, like, never again.
Yeah.
It's by the more you educate people about it, the easier it is to protect people from that happening ever again. But, you know, there's not really anything like that in the area, so he had never seen anything like that. And I guess I don't think he really, like, knew what it was. Obviously, he knew what a museum was, but a museum wasn't the right word to capture what we wanted to do. So we actually, he applied to get a visa to come visit my family and didn't get it. So he was, like, really angry and frustrated. And so I was like, let's just go travel somewhere else. And we ended up with this, like, crazy idea. We did a motorcycle trip all the way to Peru. And then we flew from there to Chile to visit his cousin. And there we went to Via Grimaldi, which is basically a memorial center about La Guerra Sucia that happened in Chile with the dictatorship. And we walked out and he was like, yeah, I get it. We have to do that.
That's really cool that you could put it into that context. That's really interesting. And then he could see it also in a South-South concept, you know, down in Chile rather than a North American or a European version. I think that's very interesting indeed.
No, exactly. And I think that's also the power of these spaces, is it gives voice to other people.
Mm.
So when you've been collecting this, the information, now you've got obviously your boyfriend's family and his contacts and so on, but they come through. Tell us a little bit about some of the stories that have been popping up. I mean, you told me a couple in, you know, of items. If you haven't, let's say, given it all away in the emails of communication that we've had. But let me just say, you know, you've got obviously indigenous stories because there are all sorts of indigenous groups in the area. You've got stories about the guerrillas, and you've got stories about the paramilitaries, and even you mentioned that there's a possible Nazi story. So give my listeners something to really, you know, get them hanging off the edge of their seat to listen to what you're doing up there.
Yeah, absolutely. I do have to say, this is like a really interesting process, because when we first started, nobody wanted to give us anything. We had a huge advantage, and that was in that Manuel's family has a lot of history here. They're one of the biggest, oldest families in the area. So when we started, we only had pictures like from them, and we only had stories from them. We got people in the community and asked them if they want to be a part of it, if they want to share their stories, and everybody told us no. And that was really frustrating to start out with. And I realized it's really just because they've been taken advantage of so many times. There are so many people who have come here to do a documentary, to do a thesis, to start a foundation, and they end up taking that information and like selling it and leaving and not leaving anything for the community. So it's been a really, really long process just to get like the trust of people to come forward and share even pictures with us. So luckily we're like going forward. There's like new people every day, and there's new incredible stories every day. I learned that one about Simón Bolívar. There's also, we found historical records that there's a theory that the first coffee beans in the entire continent of South America first came to the port of Santa Marta. And coffee only grows above a certain altitude, so it would have been here that they planted the first coffee plants. So that's a really interesting little historical fact. We have this story that I mentioned to you about the Nazis, that supposedly a plane crashed way up on the mountain. And I actually, Manuel had told me that story. I had heard it from a couple different people. But then somebody came in and like told the story of what they think happened, which is this plane crashed way on the mountain in a high up place called Cerro Kennedy. And they said it had to be from Europe because they were all tall and white. So they were like, it's from somewhere in Europe. And they say everybody died, but supposedly there was one survivor. And the survivor showed up in town with full Nazi uniform and lived on the mountain like as like a hermit for like 3 years. And then one day, really suddenly, a bunch of really fancy cars came and like got him, and they never saw him again.
That's incredible. So he must have gone off to Barranquilla where there was a Nazi party.
Probably. But you know, that's like the man that told us the story was like very convinced that it was Hitler himself. And I would be very surprised if that were true. But you know, it makes you realize that being here, you really never know. This is a place where anything could happen, anything could be true, and you really don't know. It could be.
Well, of course, you've been following the news in Colombia. I mean, the most interesting things that have come up are the most bizarre. I did a show some episodes ago to try and sort of decipher some this book and articles that came out some about Hitler living in Tunja in Boyacá for a while. So maybe he spent 3 years in the Sierra Nevada and then went down to Tunja. I don't know. I mean, I doubt it. But fascinating that people should think that. And I mean, but this guy who told you, who's very serious, I mean, did he see the man, or was it his family or someone else?
No, they saw him and they saw his uniform. They knew he didn't speak any Spanish. The only thing he said, because I have to look at the interview to remember what the actual phrase was, but apparently the only thing he learned how to say is like, "¿Dónde está café? ¿Dónde está café?" He said it in like really broken Spanish with a really terrible accent. And so that's what they called him, because they didn't even know his name.
Okay. Well,
called him like "¿Dónde café?" or something. Something like really random.
I love this. He crashed up there, liked it, stuck around for the coffee for 3 years, and then was rescued by his, I don't know, whomever. So tell us a bit more about the even more contemporary stuff, because this is where it gets delicate, of course, between the guerrillas and the paramilitaries.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people that come here to Minca more and more have some sort of concept of what the history here was like. They know that there were guerrilla here. Sometimes they know that the paramilitary were here also, because here the conflict did touch the area by both sides. But people really don't realize on the whole how recent that was. They don't realize that this was like 2011, 2012, when these families started coming back to their houses and farms. And before that, it was really just like too dangerous to leave your house and go to the store.
Wow.
So that's like some of the really interesting dynamics of Minka that I think a lot of people miss out on, is just like, this is a place that passed through 30 plus years of really, really intense violence, and then instantly international tourism. Because I think that's one of the reasons why Minka is unique, because there are so many small towns in Colombia that were hugely impacted by the armed conflict. But Minka has a unique history because it was instant international tourism that arrived after. This is like 2011, 2012. People came back to their houses and farms and found them completely destroyed and abandoned. So they sold as much land as they could really quickly. And Minka's just like the perfect place because it's so close to Santa Marta. You know, you can be sitting up on the mountain and you have a beach view. You have an oceanfront view from the mountain. So it's like a really incredible place. And international investors saw that really quickly. And they bought all of the land in Minka almost instantly. And so they started to build these big hostels and hotels and restaurants, but immediately after the conflict. And that's caused a lot of like very strange social dynamics and issues in the town.
Is there a certain degree of, I don't know, is there any sort of indifference by the local people, the traditional people, or are they indignant, or do they feel they've been pushed out like happens in many places?
I think in the moment, they were like excited that people valued so much their area and wanted to come in. People are still somewhat excited about tourism here. Because they see it as an economic step up, as a way to make money. But I think they're starting to see more and more that like that's not the reality. So like, and I know you talked about the tourism industry episodes, which I found really interesting. But one of like the really difficult things about tourism is it's not an easy investment. Tourism is really fickle. It depends on so many things. It depends on the natural climate, it depends on politics, it depends on fashion. Tourism isn't a very stable investment. And I see it very much as like a low-hanging fruit. So a lot of people see that there's a lot of money to be made really quickly. And so they start investing in it without like thinking of the later on implications. One of the really unfortunate things in the area is that most people from here don't have the economic stability to be able to go and travel. And because of that, they don't know what travelers are looking for, what travelers like. So when you have a foreigner that comes in, obviously it is so much easier for them to start a successful hostel, a successful restaurant, because they've been to 200 of them. And they know what like calls people attention, what's interesting. Whereas people here, I would say if you talk to almost anybody in town, their goal is to save enough money to start a hostel. But when they start a hostel, it's just like a cement building with some beds. It's not like the same atmosphere, and that's just something that you get traveling, that like you get the experience that people from here just like don't have they don't have the resources to be able to have seen or to be able to know. Another huge thing is language issues. So if you don't have another language, it's really hard to interact with travelers. People don't have websites, and they especially don't have websites in like bilingual websites, so they can't accept reservations. You know, a lot of things like that, where it's so easy for people from the city or people from elsewhere to come in and have way more success than the people from here. So the people from here see what tourism has to offer, how it can stimulate the economy, how it can raise the standard of living. But in reality, it's a lot harder for them to actually be competitive in that tourist market.
I think that description of it being the low-hanging fruit is very telling. And of course, these are the benefits that I had opening up my place in Mompox, you know, the 11 years ago, 10 years ago or so. It was exactly that. And of course, we have seen the boom in hotels, hostels, et cetera, ever since. But as you said, you know, a few beds thrown into a room made of breeze blocks. It's a different story altogether. And yes, there are those negatives that, of course, come with it. And but tell us, I mean, it sounds to me that you're completely accepted in the community. You seem to be the bridge, you know, between let's say foreigners and the local community there. I mean, you're in a relationship with a local. You're setting up this Centro de Memoria. You've talked about Nazis, guerrillas, paramilitaries, but tell us about the original Aboriginal, the indigenous people, the original people from the area. I mean, do you have much contact with them?
You know, that's another thing where I have to thank Manuel, my boyfriend, because it's really him and his family that make this project possible. They're the ones that have the history and the contact. His father actually works in the Clínica Indígena in Santa Marta.
Wow.
And his family that have roots with the Casa Indígena in Santa Marta. So we're very lucky to have a lot of contacts through them that have helped us a lot in trying to like build this story and share with the people that come through. So yeah, here in the Sierra Nevada, there's four different indigenous groups. There's one called the Kankpamo that live on the other side of the mountain in the Sierra Nevada of Valledupar.
Mm-hmm.
On this side, in the Sierra Nevada of Santa Marta, there's three, the Kogi, the Wiwa, and the Arawaku.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we're just starting. So we're building those contacts now. We were invited to a Wiwa community a couple weeks ago. We were actually helping to film a documentary. And so we got the really incredible opportunity to talk with the Mamo there, to talk with a few important people in the community. And we're trying as much as we can to have them be the ones tell their own story.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously difficult, and you know, but you do the documentary and you keep it there for the people, keep it in your Centro de Memoria. Don't do as previous documentary makers have done before you.
Yeah, that's the hope, that's the idea. Mm-hmm. And you know, I do think it's really important to have in this area because, you know, when you walk around Minka, there's so many different indigenous artifacts and relics. Like the house where we have our museum, our memorial center, is on an original indigenous terrace.
Mm-hmm.
You can see all over, you can see in Casa Loma, you can see in the big Hotel Minka, La Casona, there's indigenous paths
mm-hmm.
and artifacts all over this area. But the people here in Minka, even the locals recognize that they're withdrawing more and more because the indigenous do not want to be in society. They want to be as removed as possible because they feel that that's contamination. It's spiritual contamination. And so the more people come here, the further away they go.
Mm.
And something that I find really, really amazing about this particular region of Colombia, the indigenous people here, is actually the really beautiful relationship they have with the Colombian people.
Mm.
Because in a lot of places, that like culture difference between indigenous and the rest of the population is they don't treat each other very well.
Mm.
But here they have a beautiful relationship. The indigenous actually call the Colombians Bonache, which means little brothers.
Yeah.
And the Colombians call them hermanos mayores, the older brothers, to like because they do have a lot of respect for these four indigenous groups in the Sierra Nevada.
Amazing. And have you been invited to go off and like into the interior of the Sierra Nevada and spend time in their communities?
No, we just haven't been here long enough.
Yeah.
We're trying. No, we're trying.
Yeah.
But it's a long process and it's hard to get to because this Wiwa community that we went to, we were asking for an easily accessible community because obviously we went like a camera crew and everything. And so it wasn't just like you could take a car to get out there. But the easiest access was like a 4-hour drive, 2 hours on really intense dirt roads. When I say dirt roads, I mean like a car will probably not get up it. You have to go on foot, on a horse or mule or in moto because there's no way to get there. And we're like, wow, if it is that hard to get to the easiest town, what is it going to be like to get further away?
Well, you see, I like this. I like these places that they're just so far away that they maintain their, again, I mean, they're going to be affected. Of course they are, because there's access, albeit you know, not great, but I like that these places exist beyond our knowledge. I think it's important in this day and age where everything is so immediate, and that we expect everything in the snap of a fingers or the blink of an eye. But when you start planning a trip like the one you've been doing, it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that you've got I think they're chicks in the background, right?
There are. Manuel's father loves animals. He has like dogs and cats and pins everywhere.
And of course, they've seen you, and so they've all come to congregate around you because you are recording. I mean, they know it.
Yes, of course. That is how things work here.
So, Shenandoah, it's really fascinating. It's really interesting what you're doing. Now, could you just give us an idea of when you walk into the Casa Balaguer and into the Centro de Memoria de la Sierra, what are people going to see? So photographs that have been donated from all different families of the region?
Yeah, the idea is like it's the family photo album of the community. And that's really like the concept that we try to give when people enter also, is it's like that feeling of when you go to a close friend's house, or maybe like somebody have a relationship's house, and the family like pulls out the old photo album and they're like telling you the story of all the pictures and people in them. It's really like that moment that we're trying to capture here. So we try to make it as personal as possible. You come in and you see photographs all over the wall, and they're all, some of them are new and some of them are historic, and we have them organized kind of sequentially. They have a section about the indigenous, we have a section about the history of coffee, because all the people that live here, the original people, were actually coffee workers, people that were brought over from all over the place to work with coffee in the region. We have a section of how Minka was before, how united the community was, different events that they would all do together, religious events, Halloween, things like that. And then we have the section of both sides of armed conflict, and then Minka before and after, so how the tourism is changing the infrastructure of the town. And then we have, I'm finishing this up right now, we have another room also where we're going to project the interviews that we're doing, and finishing up subtitles on the first few right now, but it's a really slow process.
Yeah, definitely.
But hopefully we'll have that done this month. We have those two rooms, one where you can listen directly to the interviews, and then one where you can see the pictures and ask questions and like interact with the history.
Wow, I mean, it sounds like an incredible investment, not only of time, but also money as well, getting this done.
Yeah, it's been an adventure because both of us are like young student professional. Like, we don't have huge savings to be able to invest in this. So we really started out with nothing. So like, the only money we invested to start out with is like fixing up the house. Guys, so this house is an incredible historic monument, I think, because it's the oldest house in all of Minka, and it still has all of its original structure. It's tapia pisada, which is like adobe, but it's like a little bit falling apart. It needs a little bit of love. We fixed up the first part, and we really just like started with that. And we started with just like three chairs, and people would walk by, and we just like invite them to coffee and invite them to like hear the history and like ask whatever questions they might have.
Nice.
And we've been so lucky that people that have come by have been very, very generous with us. Like I said, we do all of this for donations. But people have been so, so generous. And people, sometimes their donation isn't even in money. We have artists that are like, oh, I can help you fix that. Or people that have done translation work or are bilingual and are like, yeah, we'll help you do that translation. So, you know, we've been really, really lucky with the people that have come through.
Nice. So where do you see, hang on a second, where do you see it in a couple of years? And where do you see yourself in a couple of years?
I don't know. My plans were to go back to school, but I'm so excited by this project and like the different opportunities that it's bringing that I would be very happy to stay here and work doing this. I'd like to have a little bit more space. We'd like to have a local art gallery, because there's a lot of kids here that have really incredible talent and like don't have a place to show it. We'd like to have one of our other projects be able to tell people, like, we do our work for volunteer donations, the idea being that all of the money after like we pay rent and have to sustain the project, the rest of the money goes to community development projects. So one of those is like we're doing English classes, we're doing like scholarship searches, like business workshops. and it would be really helpful to be like to like have the space to do that.
I can understand that.
So we'd really like that, and I think our like goal of what we want to be in a couple of years is we'd really like to have more integration, more interaction between the travelers that come here and the locals, because there are so many really, really interesting people arriving here, people that are like in some cases experts in their field. We have like world-class bird watchers, botanists, biologists, people from all over the world that come here because it's such a biodiverse area. And we think that would be really, really interesting if we could connect those people with locals, so the locals actually have the opportunity to learn from those people that come here.
Yeah, definitely. So finally, I mean, I hate to ask, do you have a website so we can check it out?
We do. Okay. It's still a free website because I have no website experience.
That's fine. Tell us the website.
It's memoria.wixsite.com/minka.
Memoria de la Sierra Wix. Okay, but I'll put it on the Facebook. I'll put it on Facebook and I'll put it on Twitter so people can link directly to it and click directly to it.
Yeah. So, okay. And it might be easier actually. We're on Facebook. Our Facebook is Memoria de la Sierra. That has the link to it. We're also on Instagram, Memoria Minka.
Yeah.
Memorial.
Yeah,
check us out.
Yeah, definitely. So listen, let me just take this moment to say thank you so much to Shenandoah for this time. I know you're busy up there in Minka. You know, we get the impression that people laze around in hammocks up there in the beautiful climate, watching the tropical birds and listening to the waterfalls. I mean, you are a busy person in Minka. So thank you for your time and sharing what you're doing with us here, the listeners at Columbia Calling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for giving us the space to talk.
Yeah. It's fascinating, really fascinating. I've got to make an effort and get back up to Minka. But as we all know, Colombia has too much. That's its Achilles heel. There's too much to see in this country. I've 12 years into being here. And I only got to Casanare this year. I mean, this is why I still need Putumayo. I still need Arauca. I still need other places to go to. But anyway, we try and cover as much as we possibly can here on Columbia Calling. So let's a quick thank you on this episode 254 to Shenandoah Cornish, native of Flagstaff, Arizona, up there in Minka Magdalena in the Sierra Nevada. Do check out her Centro de Memoria de la Sierra in the Casa Balaguera, free to enter in Minka, but voluntary donations are greatly accepted. This has been a very interesting episode, and of course we'll be back with 255 next week with another interview doing something or with something to do with Colombia. So thank you again for listening, and yes, keep spreading the word, keep sharing us on Twitter, Facebook, and whatever, Instagram and other social media evils that we need to use today. So thank you again. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall signing off on this episode 254.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.